The court calls 13-20-160-CV Superior Health, Inc. versus Legacy Home Health.
Okay, may it please the court. And before we begin, following protocol, I want to introduce trial counsel with me today, Brad Hancock with the firm of Holland & Knight, joining me at counsel table. This case is the poster child case to affirm that an award of unsegregated attorney's fees should be refuted, and the trial court's confirmation and the arbitrator's award should be reversed because the arbitrator exceeded his authority under the Texas Arbitration Act, Section 171.088A. This case has everything that you might imagine should be in a case that needs to be reversed for failure to arbitrate. There were four plaintiffs, complainants in this case, who fought for 7 years from 2013, I'm aging myself just as one of these, way back, from 2013 through 2020, certainly through the arbitration part of that, four parties were in this case, only one recovered. Three of them, they're called the legacy ancillary entities by the arbitrator, didn't recover a dime. In fact, they didn't recover a penny. And in fact, the one entity that recovered, Legacy, only recovered 1/7 of the $25 million or so that it asked for. And it had floated numbers around $63 million. And if that's the number that they were asking for, they only recovered less than 5%. In addition, the arbitrator refuted the consequential damages request by Legacy, the prevailing party. So they received very much less, as the complainant's affidavit in support of their attorney's fees acknowledge, much lower than the amount that they asked for. In addition, all of these parties had experts. Legacy had an expert, the three ancillary entities had an expert, and the arbitrator dismissed as speculation the expert report seeking damages for the ancillary entities who did not recover. So the arbitrator exceeded his authority, not because he got the amount wrong, but because the arbitration agreement did not authorize him to not follow the law. The arbitrator's authority is confined, is determined.
So are you saying that the arbitrator had to follow what is set out by the Remedies Code Section 38?
I'm saying that, Your Honor, but I'm also saying even more. This arbitration agreement had very specific terms.
Right.
And this court in Thunder Rose and in Vaughn versus Marsh, as well as the Texas Supreme Court in Tony Gello Motors, were very specific that if there's a case where parties seeking attorney's fees and there are multiple claims and multiple parties at issue, it must be segregated. Now, the complainants are going to come back, the appellees are going to come back with an argument about percentage reduction. I'll come to that in a little bit, but that still doesn't undermine the specific instructions from this court and the Supreme Court that in this type of case, where there's multiple parties, that there must be segregation. Now, the scope of the arbitrator's authority. In the arbitration agreement, section 10.13, and the parties agree that Texas law governs. There's no dispute there. The arbitration agreement, again, section 10.13, provides the arbitrators shall have no right to vary or ignore the terms of this agreement and shall be bound by controlling law, which is Texas law. So this provision is very specific. You've got to follow binding Texas law, and you have no right to vary it. That is the boundary of the arbitrator's authority. He went outside it by awarding unsegregated attorney's fees and also overlaying a just and equitable declaratory judgment act concept.
Kind of sounds like a silly question, Mr. Rivett, but how do we know he didn't segregate the awards?
He said he didn't.
Okay.
And in the affidavit that the complainants, the appellees, filed in support of their attorney's fee award, and in the supplement to that affidavit, that they state multiple times that they did not segregate the attorney's fees here.
I'm going to assume that they're going to argue that they were unable to segregate the awards to a certain extent, because even though there was multiple plaintiffs, the issues before the arbitrator were one and the same. So doesn't Texas law say that if they're so intertwined and they can't be segregated, then arbitrator does what the arbitrator does, just right. Gives them one lump sum.
Right. They do make that argument, Judge. They say it's impossible to segregate. They say there was no need to segregate because all the facts arise from the same dispute for all four parties. But that in itself is a misstatement of the law. The law is not that if the dispute arises from all the same facts for the parties that you don't have to segregate. Tony Gello's clear. Thunder Rose is clear. You have to segregate if, and the intertwined concept is only applicable, if the facts overlap and there are both recoverable and unrecoverable claims. They make the argument that just because the facts were intertwined, they don't have to segregate, and they don't get there. And again, the arbitrator failed to follow and to not vary from controlling law and awarded unsegregated fees. In fact, in the supplement to the final award in December of 2019 from the arbitrator, that's the part of the award in which the arbitrator addressed attorney's fees specifically. I believe it's two pages. It's at the second volume of the clerk's record, starting at 1440. He said, quote, some of the work done and costs incurred in this case was specific to the ancillary entities and should not be recovered. Notwithstanding that recognition, he still did not segregate the fees. Now, let's talk about the 95% rule that the appellees are arguing. And they cite Tony Gello Motors. Probably everybody on the bench here remembers back in the old days when attorney's fees could be recovered with just a couple of statements by the lawyer in the case. Attorney's fees testimony was not required to meet the same standard as other expert testimony. Well, Tony Gello Motors changed that, and Kinsel from the Texas Supreme Court changed that, and Thunder Rose changed that, and Justice Longoria, you're on that panel. Vaughn changed that. Justice Benavides, you authored that opinion. Now attorney's fee testimony, a la Arthur Anderson and Ramos, has to meet the expert requirements, which means there must be evidence in support of either segregated fees where appropriate or unsegregated fees, and the 90% award here was not segregated. In fact, as I just read, the arbitrator admitted some of this work should not be compensated under Chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Now, Tony Gello Motors goes through at length the evidentiary requirements for attorney's fee award and why segregation is necessary. The evidence has to support the award. That's the bottom line. And it does mention in a sentence that if counsel were to say 95% was appropriate, then that could support an award of 90% of what was requested. And it doesn't discuss it any further. And perhaps the court should have discussed it somewhat more because it had spent so many pages explaining the evidentiary requirements for attorney's fee reward. But then this court filled in the gap. In the Thunder Rose opinion, at page 15, almost on all fours with this case. The party seeking attorney's fees in that submission, in this Thunder Rose case, stated, and I'll just read it if I may, it's very brief. Quote, over 95% of all drafting time would have been necessary if there had been no alternative causes of action asserted. However, that affidavit did not state that any particular services advanced both recoverable and unrecoverable claims. Accordingly, the award was erroneous, and that's what we have here. It is counterintuitive and contradicts Tony Gello Motors to say you can just pick a number, a percentage reduction, and then ignore all the segregation requirements. Think of where that leads the jurisprudence if that were the law. You never have to segregate. You just pick a number. 99% of the work I did the last 10 years was recoverable, and that's what I should get. And the arbitrator relied on that number. It's a conclusory statement in the affidavit. There was no segregation as the affiant in support of Appley's submission for attorney's fees admitted, and it's a conclusory statement. The awarded fees must be segregated, and that did not happen here. Now, there was some suggestion in the affidavit in support of attorney's fees that none of the fees were incurred solely for the ancillary entities. But that still doesn't comply with Thunder Rose, which says the affidavit in that case in support of attorney's fees was defective because it did not confirm that there was a reduction for recoverable and non-recoverable claims. In addition, the affidavit talks about different claims, but never really focuses in on the fact that there are four parties here. 75% of them got zero recovery. The same principles in Tony Gela Motor apply when you have multiple parties as when you have multiple claims.
Mr. Wainwright, before you finish up, I do want to talk about the argument of waiver that is made by the appellant. Waiver, that the objections that you are making before this court were not objections that you made before the arbitrator, and as such that you waived the argument of some of the objections, not all of them, but the majority of your objections to the attorney's fees before this court.
Your Honor, none of what I've argued to this point involves any of the waiver arguments that they've made. Now, as to the costs, the contract is crystal clear. Both sides should bear their own cost. Instead, the arbitrator awarded $300,000 plus of costs against us, against the appellants here. That was wrong. Is that beyond exceeding the scope of his authority? The arbitration agreement says split it. You bear your own costs. And it says not only are you bound by controlling law, but you cannot vary controlling law. I think what's appropriate there procedurally, Your Honor, in my opinion, is if and when the court remands this for a reconsideration of attorney's fees, and that's the appropriate remedy here. We're not asking for a rendition of zero. We're asking for a remand to consider segregated fees and follow the law in Thunder Rose and Tony Gela Motors. When that remand happens, hopefully, then costs which go hand in hand can change depending on the attorney's fees, that all should be considered on remand, Justice Benavides, in my opinion.
Yes, I'm glad you addressed that issue because I had it as one of my notes. What are you asking for? To remand it, to reconsider the attorney's fees as the evidence did come in and make them segregated?
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly.
And you're also asking for remand to consider whether or not costs were appropriate under the terms of the arbitration agreement.
Yes.
Is it your position they were completely unwarranted?
Yes, that's correct, Justice Longoria. Certainly it was completely unwarranted to award, to not split them 50-50 and tax them all against against the appellants here. If there are no other questions, Justice Benavides, may I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal?
You can. You will have instead of your 5 minutes, 6 minutes and a half.
Thank you, Justice. Rebuttal.
I'm going to let you start your argument, but I would like you to start with the costs after you begin, and as opposed to starting with the attorney's fees, and address where he ended, where you started, if you don't mind, Ms. Wilson. I don't want to.
Yes,
I know you have a beginning introduction, and I don't want to ruin that for you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Natalie Wilson on behalf of the Appley Legacy Home Health Services. I think, Justice Benavides, you must have read my mind because that is where I was going to start, because in truth, I think the issue of costs can be very easily disposed. Just Superior would have the court look at the contract and stop its inquiry there. And I agree, the language of the contract says the parties shall bear their own costs, except they shall split the costs of AAA arbitration. But the court has to look further because the arbitrator's authority is also determined by the submissions of the party. And both parties in this case pleaded for and requested costs. In fact, in the affidavit on attorney's fees submitted by Tricia De Leon, who was lead trial counsel at the arbitration proceeding, she requested in her affidavit $215,000 in costs. Clearly, the parties had a unified intent to have the arbitrator award costs. Further, there is no evidence in the record before you that Superior objected to Legacy's request for costs in front of the arbitrator. That evidence isn't there because Superior did not make an appellate record for the district court. And the record that you do have, which is the record of Superior's motion to vacate, does not address costs at all. It doesn't mention costs. If you read the reporter's record, costs are not mentioned at all. So there's no evidence that it was preserved before the arbitrator. The evidence in the record shows that it was not preserved before the district court, and therefore it was waived. And on remand,
I'm a little confused, Ms. Wilson.
Sure.
So the contract definitely says parties incurred same. I mean, that each of them incur their own. I mean, it's all real clear. Each of them bear their own costs. So where are we getting this language or understanding that they get to go outside of their contract and plead for more than what's in the contract? And how do we get there? That's where I'm having my confusion.
Sure. And I mean, I want to make sure that I get the right case site for you. May I come back to that question?
Yes,
I have too many tabs, and I don't want to waste.
Just don't forget to answer.
The time, sure. There is.
Just go ahead and proceed, Ms. Wilson. I'll make a note, and I won't let you forget before you say.
I think I may have found it. It's definitely in our briefs. The authority that by submission the parties can agree to expand the arbitrator's authority. So here's my citations. It's the Soccer versus Ghanem case.
Okay.
And of course, it's the first one on my pile.
Of course.
I can give you the site. It's in our briefs, but it's a case out of Beaumont, 2008 Westlaw 526-3359. And kind of just to wrap up this thought, because Superior also requested its costs and did not object to the award of costs to Legacy based on the contract language, they either waived it, they submitted the issue to the arbitrator, or they invited the error that they now complain of.
Are you saying because they also asked for costs outside of the contract, that's what their waiver was?
The waiver was their failure to object. Okay. The submitting it in Ms. De Leon's affidavit is the submission to the arbitrator authorizing him to rule on the question, setting it before him.
Okay, I found it.
So I mentioned that the record before this court is incomplete, and counsel, when he started his argument, jumped right into the issue of segregation and started talking about the evidence. And respectfully, I think he skipped a few steps that the court needs to analyze. The first is whether the language in this contract truly expanded the scope of review that the district court could undertake. And it didn't. There is no clear agreement to expanded judicial review as is permitted under NAFTA. The eight words that Superior is hanging its hat on are the arbitrators shall be bound by controlling law. That type of language has not been found to expand judicial review under NAFTA repeatedly. And very recently by this court, Justice Longoria, in your opinion in Sanchez versus Doctors Hospital at Renaissance. The language in Sanchez was the arbitrator shall apply the internal laws of Texas, which sounds an awful lot like the arbitrator shall be bound by controlling law to me. And to if the court were to adopt Superior's position, the exception would swallow the rule being limited judicial review of arbitration decisions. I'd like to.
So you're saying that we can't even review the attorney's fees under the current law, even if we are to find that he went outside of his authority? We normally leave arbitrations alone. I mean, we all know
correct.
That. And there's very few circumstances, exceptions where we can review fraud, duress. But one of them is if they go outside of their scope of authority. So isn't that the review we're doing in this case?
The narrow scope of authority under the TAA, when an arbitrator exceeds his or her authority, is not a mistake of law. It's whether he or she decides something that is not properly before him. There is no dispute that the issue of attorney's fees
was you're telling properly. Us if the arbitrator awards, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, damages for something that is not recoverable. We're all going to sit here and agree that, you know, that this type of damages is not recoverable, that the Court of Appeals can't review and said you can't give money for that if that's not recoverable?
If the default review applies, I think that is correct, Your Honor. For example, let's say the arbitrator had awarded emotional distress damages
right.
on a breach of contract case. If only limited review applies, that is an error in applying Texas law. That is not an excess of the arbitrator's authority if that breach of contract okay. claim was properly before the arbitrator. In this case, attorney's fees indisputably were properly before the arbitrator. Superior's complaint is that the arbitrator misapplied the law regarding segregation of fees.
Well didn't award attorney's fees pursuant to what we now have a whole slew of case law of how you're supposed to follow, you know, Mr. Rainwright's right. We all remember where we all just stand up and say, my attorney's fees were so much, and that's all that was necessary. I used to do it back. I think we all did it back in the day. So, but now the court has set out very specific parameters. And if that parameter is not followed, isn't that also a mistake of law that can be judicially reviewed?
Not, Your Honor, respectfully, not under the narrow okay. review, because it is a mistake of law. If a trial court did that, absolutely, it would be reversible error if it were harmful. But here the arbitrator gets so much deference because of the strong policy favoring arbitration, favoring its finality, and disfavoring relitigating the same issues. I said the exception would swallow the rule. The other thing is arbitration would become a warm-up. If there was an expansive interpretation of the language regarding the arbitrator's authority, it would become a dress rehearsal and nothing more, and a very, very expensive one.
What about costs, though? I mean, that is specifically in the contract. So, I mean, it flips the previous argument on its face. You think the costs were properly awarded?
I do believe the costs were properly awarded because both parties essentially agreed to modify that provision of the arbitration award. They also, by agreement, didn't go to AAA mediation. We went to mediation before George Brin of Conflict Solutions of Texas. We didn't apply the AAA rules. And both parties submitted for costs. So if Superior asks for costs, does not object to Legacy asking for costs, they have lost the right to come before this court and complain that costs were awarded to Legacy.
Okay.
Continuing, so the court should not find that requiring arbitrators to apply governing law expands the scope of judicial review. But in this case, even if the parties had contracted for that expanded review, it cannot happen. NAFTA Traders itself recognizes that if you're going to have expanded judicial review, the party seeking to vacate or modify the award is obligated to provide the court with the full record of the arbitration. And Superior did not do that here. There were 18 days of arbitration proceedings that were transcribed, no transcripts in this record. The hundreds of exhibits that Mr. Brin reviewed, not in the record on appeal. The invoices in support of Superior, or excuse me, of Legacy's request for fees, not in the record. Without that record, the court must presume that the arbitrator's decision was correct. Superior cannot show any harmful errors without that record. They were the party with the burden to make the record, and they didn't. However, what we do have is Ms. Cardona's affidavit. And Superior maintains that Legacy pulled the 5% out of a hat, out of thin air. In fact, at pages 1763 to 1792 of the second volume of the clerk's record, that's Ms. Cardona's affidavit, Ms. Cardona went through in fairly exhaustive detail the work that Legacy did. She, again, was lead trial counsel, making her affidavit from her personal knowledge of the work that had been performed up to the proceeding and at the proceeding. She detailed the work that could have been done that would have only advanced the claims of the ancillary entities who prevailed on liability but not damages. And she also detailed why that work was extremely limited, and that most of the work done on the breach of contract claims brought by the ancillary entities did double service for Legacy's successful breach of contract claim. It was not a number pulled out of the air. And specifically, I would point the court to paragraph 6 of Ms. Cardona's supplemental affidavit, which is found at page 1791 of the second volume of the clerk's record. Additionally, in the award, Mr. Brin, who had sat through 18 days of testimony, 20 witnesses, hundreds of exhibits, numerous lengthy pretrial motions, considered all of the evidence before him in determining that most of the work done on behalf of the ancillary entities would have been done even if those entities did not have claims before him. And that...
So is the argument that they're so intertwined, or are you just saying that the evidence before the court was that this was how much was expended in attorney's fees in order to bring forth the prevailing party here, Legacy's claim?
It's a little bit of both. So it is that the work for the ancillary entities largely did double service of proving Legacy's successful breach of contract claim. And Ms. Cardona detailed what that work was. So Legacy's proof of retaliation and pretext was largely circumstantial. Part of that circumstantial evidence was that at the same time that Superior terminated Legacy's contract in retaliation for complaints that Legacy had made about cuts to services and slow payment of claims, at the same time Superior terminated Legacy's contract, it also retaliated by terminating the contracts of the three other entities. And all four entities showed that there was no basis, either in fact or law or under the contracts, to terminate the other three entities. And so that circumstantial evidence that Superior was wrongfully terminating the ancillary entities at the same time it terminated Legacy's contract, it all built into that circumstantial evidence of wrongful conduct, retaliatory conduct by Superior, and it exposed the pretext of the termination. But that's why Ms. Cardona detailed what amount of work or what activities, pardon me, I have the same allergies, I think.
They're bad, and then it's kind of stuffy in here because we're having trouble with the AC, so that's why it's warm in here. It's usually freezing in this courtroom.
Well, I appreciate that because I'm always cold. But so Ms. Cardona's affidavit detailed which activities would have or could potentially be attributable solely to the unsuccessful breach of contract claims by the ancillary entities, and it was very little work. That 5% discount represented about 260 hours of work to be pulled out and unrecoverable. What Mr. Brin gave, his deduction of 10% is over 500 hours. So the percentages sound small, but the deductions are huge. And the deductions that Superior asked for at arbitration, and again before the district court, a 75% pro rata deduction based on successful entities versus unsuccessful entities, or an over 90% deduction based on the alleged pro rata difference between recovered compensatory damage and claimed damages, have no basis in law. They had no basis in the evidence. And those are the arguments they preserved. They did not preserve any arguments, and they cannot point to any single time entry to this court to say this work would not have been done if the three unsuccessful ancillary entities who didn't recover damages were not before the arbitrator. None of that evidence is here. And so if the court were to remand for a reconsideration of the attorney's fees, we would end up with the exact same judgment, because the district court does not have the record it needs to reassess the attorney's fees. And I'm not sure that the district court has that authority. They could modify the award. The district court could modify the award, but not on this record. Not on this record.
Would the argument then be that the affidavit of Ms. Cardona isn't sufficient to meet out the standards that has been set out by the Texas Supreme Court and that we have followed in the Thunder Rose case?
Yes, Ms. Cardona's affidavit is sufficient. It is not merely a statement that 95% of the work would have been done with nothing more. She analyzes the work that was done. And without the invoices to support it, the record is insufficient, and that insufficient record is fatal.
So you said that the court can't review it because there's not sufficient in order to reconsider it, but the opposite end of that argument is that the arbitrator, with only the affidavits, didn't have sufficient evidence in order to award this damage.
The arbitrator had the invoices. The invoices were attached. Those invoices were not made part of the appellate record.
Okay.
And so without the full record that the arbitrator had, the court has to presume that the arbitrator's decision was correct. I see that I'm almost out of time, so unless anybody has more questions, I'll happily yield my 30 seconds back.
Any questions?
No questions.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
So did you object to the cost, Mr. Wainwright? She says you didn't object at the level, and therefore it's waived on the costs.
Your Honor, there was not an objection in the trial court to the costs. However, the agreement clearly was contradicted, violated by the arbitration award, just wrong. And
so it doesn't matter whether you objected or not, because it's outside of the scope of the contract.
Well, this is not a sufficiency of the evidence review, as you pointed out. This is just whether, as a matter of law, and it is a legal question for the court, the arbitrator exceeded his authority. However, to follow up on the point I made earlier, since the arbitrator admitted, put to the side the affidavit, this court's going to act on the award. The arbitrator admitted there's some work that was done that I'm awarding fees for. So I'm going to pick a number, not the 5% that Appley's claim was reasonably reached, and I disagree, not challenging the credibility of the affidavit. It just didn't get there, as you pointed out. But then the arbitrator doubled it to 10%. That was not appropriate. It was wrong. And when all the case goes back, as it hopefully will, to properly segregate, since some fees were awarded that should not have been, then the three entities that did not recover may have benefited. And to that extent, the cost that they incurred should be taken out of that number. The remand to the trial court, I think, is appropriate then with instructions for the trial court to send it to the arbitrator. I don't think I've ever seen an appellate decision remand to an arbitrator, so probably to the trial court with instructions to go back to the arbitrator.
Right, it would have to go all the way back to the arbitrator.
Yes, it would. The arbitrator only has the authority in the first instance to make these decisions.
I don't know if I've ever sent it back to a trial court to send it back to an arbitrator.
I think a trial court would follow your instructions, Justice.
I don't know about that, but okay.
but here's the
you make an interesting point. We're not here on a sufficiency as to whether the
correct
attorney's fees are sufficient as an evidentiary point. We're here as a de novo review as to whether the arbitrator followed the law.
Correct. And the arbitrator did not.
So let me take you a step backwards. I told you I was going to bombard you with questions. So the appellant argues that this court does not have jurisdiction to review this because it is entitled to give attorney's fees under law. And this is just really just whether he awarded too much attorney's fees. So it's more of an evidentiary rule than not following the law. And as such, we shouldn't, this is not that he got the law wrong. He just awarded too much, and that would have been a sufficiency point, which we can't review.
Yeah, I disagree with that argument, and I'll use the example that was brought up. If the arbitrator awarded emotional distress damages for a breach of contract claim, that would be outside of the scope of his authority. The scope of the authority is not defined, I disagree on this point too, by the submissions of the parties. The scope of the authority is defined by the statute, TAA, binding Corpus Christi Edinburgh Court of Appeals opinions, and Texas Supreme Court opinions, and the arbitration agreement. The authorities say, the legal authorities, that segregation must occur in a case where you have all these moving parts, multiple entities, claims, part of the damages are refuted, 1/7 of the damages asked for, the results obtained were so low. That segregation is mandatory. Secondly, in the arbitration agreement, the other document that defines the scope of authority, it says the arbitrator has no right to vary controlling law. It doesn't say we'd like you to follow controlling law, and if you want to change it, if you think it's okay, that's fine. The arbitrator has no power to do that. The arbitrator only has the power the parties agreed that the arbitrator has. So if the arbitrator awarded emotional distress damages on a breach of contract, that is outside the arbitrator's authority. When an arbitrator here does what this one did, there are two reasons why he was outside the scope of his authority. He did not segregate. Again, put to the side what the affidavit said. What did the award say? He said, I awarded some fees that were not recoverable. He said that in the supplemental award. And secondly, he based the award on an inappropriate and an incorrect standard. And let me pull that out for you. Okay. In Appley's brief on the merits, at page 55, they state, Texas law permits, quote, in lieu of segregation of fees, an award of attorney's fees for claims that are inextricably intertwined. In that case, you can award based on a percentage reduction, they say. Well, that's just not correct. Thunder Rose sets it out properly. A party is not required to segregate fees when recoverable and non-recoverable claims are so intertwined that they need not be segregated. The intertwined component concept only comes into play when the the overlap is between recoverable and non-recoverable claims. Since they didn't segregate, and the arbitrator didn't segregate, we don't know if they're recoverable and non-recoverable claims at issue. Just because the facts overlap as among the parties doesn't mean that you don't have to segregate. That's the position that appellees argued to the arbitrator and the trial court, and that is the second reason why the arbitrator exceeded his authority, because it was outside of binding Texas law, and the arbitration agreement made him comply with that. As to the costs, I think practically they also have to be remanded, because there may be some costs that were awarded to the ancillary entities who didn't recover. Someone has to go through the record, the details, and hash that out, and be in the process of determining what the proper segregated fees are. There's one other point I want to emphasize very quickly. It's correct, the invoices, attorney's fee invoices, are not in the record, but it doesn't matter. The appellees admitted there was no segregation. The case law is clear. Segregation is mandatory. This is not a sufficiency of the evidence review. The question is, when there are those admissions and these facts, did the arbitrator violate 171.088 as a matter of law? The answer, Your Honor, is yes.
I think I got it. It's just that we usually see these on sufficiency, so we're doing it differently, and so I think it's hard for us to take that step back. Okay. But I think we've got it, Mr. Rainwright. I don't think we have any further questions for Mr. Rainwright.
No.
All right.
Thank you.
You are done for the day. The case will be under submission.